This drawing shows all the operations before and the conjunction in the background going on. The release in the head of the spirit, or the child of the philosophers. And that takes place also in the body, organically. So we look for these spiritual changes to be somewhere in the body. Now, Egyptian alchemists sought in the body the correspondences of everything that was going on spiritually and chemically and also on the physical level. They thought, and I've seen the text myself, that the energies, when you reach a point in spiritual evolution, you would stop eating food and you'd live on light or spiritual energy. In fact, Akhenaten had a whole factory in the Sinai Desert that made white gold, white substance, powder of gold, that was supposedly what him and his court, higher court, sought to live on. And when they discovered this alchemical laboratory, in fact, writings from Akhenaten that survived describe where it was at. They went there. It had been discovered by a British archaeologist many years earlier. And they went into these rooms that were filled with this white powder. And they thought it was the walls crumbling. And they just swept it out into the desert. And this was actually their warehouses for this this mana, or this gold of the gods, that was somehow processed from real gold. That they thought that the intestines were much more significant than we think. And they thought that the intestines were a serpent-like in the belly, and that this serpent would transform itself and be rejuvenated into something new when you stop eating, when it stopped serving its purpose as a digestive organ. This is very advanced thinking for such. This is an ancient culture we're talking about. In fact, during mummification, they often found balls, very solid balls, perfectly round balls that they called basilars. And basically, basilars are accoutrements of things in the belly that were in their diet at the time that melded together and made these hard balls, kind of like hair balls, but perfectly hard, black balls of mass, of undigested matter and beer and whatever else they were eating. Something about the ancient digestive system and their diet gave rise to these basilars. Well, they thought that that was the stone in the serpent below. They called it the serpent below because the intestines look like a serpent. That was a holy thing, the basilar. So they actually saved them. And they actually fed the basilars to the pharaohs as part of their transformation, that they're eating these intestinal contents, all because of the symbolism of it. But this had to be balanced by a serpent in the head, according to the Egyptian alchemist. And the brain, they thought, was the serpent in the head, the convoluted look of the brain. In the middle of the brain, they found this organ. In the brain, and you know, throughout our body, most of the things are divided into two kidneys, you know, two lobes of the brain. And the only unitary structure in the brain is this phallic-looking pineal gland, or pineal gland, as some people call it, but the original pronunciation is pineal gland because it looks like a pine cone, and it has little leaves like a pine cone. And inside there are little black crystals of melanin, which is a light-absorbing substance crystal. The Egyptian alchemists described these crystals, and they also thought that they were sacred, that they were the stone in the serpent in the head. And that's how much they were into bodily alchemy. And they saved this material, and they talked about it. And this whole idea was resurrected in the 17th century alchemists. And they thought and believe to this day that the pineal gland is the organ of transformation, of spiritual transformation in man. Children have a huge pineal gland. As we get older, it atrophies. It produces the hormone melatonin, and melatonin, we think of melatonin as regulating sleep patterns and things, but it has a lot to do with the darkness and light. It's sensitive to the light. It's in the middle of the brain, but it's sensitive to light, and it regulates menstrual patterns, the tides of the body, the lymphatic circulation. It regulates the waters of the body, and it regulates sleep patterns. It is a miraculous organ in its uniqueness, really. We know that mammals have pineal glands. In fact, in mammals, the pineal gland is up in the forehead, about here, which gives rise to this idea of the third eye. In most mammals, there's a thin layer of skin here, a membrane, where the pineal gland is accessible to the light, and that's how they regulate their patterns of night and day, and their circulation of the fluids inside their bodies. When man stood up on his two legs and orientated himself to this vertical axis of reality, the pineal gland migrated over generations to the center of the head to be orientated towards the light. That's what an amazing organ it is, and how orientated it is to the light. There's a lot with the pineal gland that modern alchemists are working with, really, because of its signatures, because of the way it behaves, and because of how it's orientated to the light. Mantak Chia, who is, I think, the best Taoist living alchemist, does a lot of work with the pineal gland, and actually I've worked with him on pineal gland alchemy and how it can be applied in the world. He does some amazing things with what's called dark room enlightenment, okay, where people go for 1 to 3 weeks in a totally darkened environment, caves in India, and for the first 3 days they're given tryptophan, huge doses of tryptophan, and they do pretty much nothing but sleep. And they wake up in this darkness, and it's pitch black. It's pitch black. The servants who bring them food and things wear night vision goggles to get around. And the people there, 20 to 30 people at a time, live in darkness, absolute total darkness, for a week, 2 weeks. There's 3 grades of initiation here, and 3 weeks. And those who get through the first week experience profound changes in visionary patterns, and kind of like being in the sarcophagus. It may be what was going on in the pyramid too, because there was a lot of work with light there, definitely a lot of work with light, and that's what we're doing here, except we're working with light in terms of absence of light, which is the pineal gland relates, for instance, in the winter months, it secretes more melatonin, which makes us sleep deeper and longer during the winter to conserve our energies. It's more than that, though. Deep sleep is the time in the darkness when bodily changes take place. Not now. It's not when you're awake and walking. The bodily metabolism is almost exclusively devoted to renewing cells and to working on damage in the body while you're sleeping. The total loss of consciousness. And it's that blackness that the alchemists worked in openly. And Taoist alchemy especially is doing some amazing things with the pineal gland. People who stay in the darkness for 2 weeks report profound spiritual changes. Those who stay in the darkness for 3 weeks report bodily changes, rejuvenations, and things like that. So this is really an interesting avenue of research, and hopefully we'll be able to hold some workshops like that over here sometime when these techniques are better balanced. That's what the Mantak Chia has documented, and these are new things. And this program's only been going on a year, and you can find out about it on the internet. Just go into his name, Mantak Chia, and there's all kinds of information about his workshop, testimonials of what's going on. And I think that Mantak Chia is a Taoist alchemist who is very genuine in a field where there are not genuine people. So I think his work is credible, and I think that the changes that he's talking about might be something, a really interesting avenue of research. And this is what we're talking about now, is a fermentation experience, which is the next level of alchemy. And it takes place in the pineal gland. The pineal gland is in the mysterious third ventricle of the brain, this open center right in the middle of the brain, and it's down a corridor, if you will. The pineal gland's at one end, and the pituitary gland is at the other end of the corridor. The pituitary gland is very much a bilobed structure, very feminine looking. So the next conclusion, and something actually believed by Renaissance alchemists, was that there's a sexual act that takes place in the brain between the pituitary gland and the pineal gland. And that gives birth to a new fetus in the brain, if you will. And it's fascinating stuff, and there were some studies done in the 1900s where they documented the pineal gland moving and vibrating and strange things like that. So it's an area of research that we should be aware of, I think, that there's actually some kind of physical chemistry going on. There are two sacred chambers in the bones in the body. One's the sacrum, or the sacred bone in Latin, and it's right down here by the Muladhara. It's a grail-shaped vessel of bone. The other one is called the sphenoid. It's the same shape vessel that supports the brain. And the sphenoid has openings. There's one opening in the center and the third ventricle of the brain. And it's in this cave-like structure where the pineal gland and the pituitary gland are at. The pituitary gland is really kind of like on the roof of your mouth. Sometimes during puberty, you can actually feel funny sensations in your mouth, like you've got a big swollen tongue. And it's actually the pituitary gland swells up when it's releasing so many hormones. It's called the master gland. It releases all the hormones that change your body during puberty and make that happen and control the cell. So it makes a lot of sense that there's something going on in the body, and that would be the other signature that the alchemists were looking for. Again, this would be the fermentation stage because we're working with light, and this moves into mercury and sulfur and how they relate together on these higher levels. So now we're starting to work beyond the elements with sulfur, mercury, and the new salt, as it's called. The fermentation stage begins. I mean, how do you enter the other side? You have to die and be reborn there, and that's the thinking. How do you be resurrected? You have to die. And that's what happens in this first stage of fermentation. It's called putrefaction. And it's beyond depression in that it's a total loss of consciousness. And that's how this Montauk Chi is where it starts. The first 3 days are almost a total loss of consciousness. And what comes after are these bursts of light and visions and bodily changes. So it's credible in that sense. A lot of the images of putrefaction are negative and scary, but you feel dead, but there's still a life force in you. Any of you who have done shamanic drugs or psychedelic drugs know that the beginning of that experience is usually where you lose consciousness for 10 minutes or whatever the drug signature is, and all of a sudden you wake up and there's all these lights and psychedelic stuff happening. But there's a loss of consciousness there, and that's a signature of putrefaction. So we're talking like the natural process of fermentation, where you take wine, you crush the grapes, and you let them set and decompose, and they become dead and rotten and stinking and black, just total blackness. It's like everything's dead, but there's always a life force, symbolized by the snake here, that's present and ready for transformation. Another fermentation is a green lion eating sun. But out of that blackness, in the laboratory where you're fermenting something, often there's a white layer that appears, and it's really digesting bacteria that's forming, kind of a white juice on top of the black stuff. And that's bacteria that are starting to digest the crushed grapes. And next, after that process, that's kind of like the white light to the other side, to the alchemist. It's like a promise or a hint that there's life beyond death. And the next phase is an oily, a real thin oil starts secreting or forming on top of the black matter. And it's iridescent and it's beautiful. It looks like a rainbow pattern. In fact, the alchemists called it the pot of Cadonis, which is the peacock's tail. They call it the peacock's tail because out of this dull bird opens these wondrous colors with eyes that seems alive. And that's what happens. And that was their indication that fermentation was taking place and that this black substance would be spiritized and be reborn. And that's what happens. It's reborn as the spirit of the grape, which is wine. So it's a breakthrough to the other side, however it happens, however we get there. It could be in meditation. Whatever it is, fermentation leads to experiences and other worlds, other world experiences. That's my whole interest in paranormal phenomena and all the investigations I've done in the sacred spots and things like that. It's because I see the genuine experiences of paranormal people as alchemical fermentations, and that their consciousness is actually being changed. I don't know, I don't have any evidence about the spirits surviving from the other side or about aliens coming from space or anything like that. But these people believe it when they're really into this change. And things start manifesting around them. Changes in physical reality start manifesting. And it's not necessarily coming from ghosts. It's coming from their effect on matter. So it's a real alchemical process going on. Call it poltergeist or whatever you want. Dishes start flying. Big bangs come from wounds. Lights flicker, electrical problems. Things happen that can't be explained. And that is very alchemical. It's the consciousness of the people going through these events. It's causing physical changes in reality, what their expectations are. And the reason they turn negative so often is because there's fear involved. And fear, when we work in alchemy, we don't have fear. You know, it's the Buddhist way, no fear. And that's the key to working in positive alchemy. Because fear, like, changes gold back into lead, okay? Fear brings things back down into the true darkness of our psychology and all the shadows that exist there. So, yeah, a lot of paranormal experiences turn out scary, but they don't have to be. And there are physical mediums throughout the world who've demonstrated that that consciousness affects reality in very mysterious ways. So it's a breakthrough to the other side. We're being reborn on a whole new level of reality that we don't know about and that's very rarely talked about even seriously by people. But it's an area of fecundity. It's creative energies available to us for transformation on the body level, spiritual level. It's really becoming creative. Artists, we were just talking about how many artists are into alchemy. There's hundreds of artists now who are studying alchemy to get that creative connection to put into their work. And that's what fermentation is about. It's connecting with that higher creative energy. Fermentation is disconcerting and unbalancing, but boy, there's plenty of creative material there. With children, for instance, in a haunted area or some type of paranormal phenomena, very often it's not the children who are frightened, it's the adults. And the children are actually talking to ghosts and working with ghosts and playing with ghosts. It's not until they're taught to be afraid of the phenomena that it turns negative. Conditioned, yeah, or watch Fright Night or something. Yeah. Again, fermentation is a process that's often overwhelming, and it's a coming together of a life force. Eyeballs are seen, and in other words, there's a living presence you're sensing, and it's taking on an intelligence, and you need to get control of it. Often, fermentation experiences are out of hand, and there are a lot of drug addicts from the 60s who thought they were on the road to nirvana where their experiences got out of hand and it ended up a disaster. And why? Because they didn't go to the next stage in alchemy. If fermentation is a like a religious experience, you know, or an unexplainable paranormal phenomena, then distillation, which is the next phase here, working with silver and the moon, is gaining quiet objectivity. Laboratory distillation, this is a painting of that phosphorus, discoverer phosphorus, where the alchemist distilled urine. He took the dregs of urine in a bottle, boiled it, the vapors went up to the top and accumulated in the vessel, and then he took that material and distilled it again. The more times you distill something, the purer and more concentrated it becomes. And finally, he had it so concentrated that he had basically nothing but phosphorus and some other chemicals, and it gave off light like this, as we were saying. That's the process, the physical process of distillation. And distillation, in other ways, is working with these two currents, usually. Two currents of energy, often deliberately working with them, shown as a sword or a soldier or something like that. There's many, many drawings of distillation, purification, vines growing up in the air and coming back down. All this, as above, so below, is a distillation process. There are more distillation drawings, I think, in alchemy than any other, because it was such an important process, such a magical process to the alchemists, that they honored it very much. In fact, they thought it was the process of the whole universe. that the whole universe is going through this distillation of spirit into matter. And the rebus, after all this distillation, you end up with a solution that's very thick. It's called the mother of the stone. In other words, it's almost matter. It's almost congealed, purified matter. And they call that the rebus, or the perfect body with both consciousness, masculine and feminine. And they thought they were making this during distillation. There's lots of diagrams of distillation, as I said. Here we see the rebus, which is male and female conjoined in one body. And the eagle behind them is lifting them up in the distillation process, and you come back down in distillation. And that below is showing all the dead bodies of the eagles from the previous processes. So there's hundreds of bodies of eagles there, representing how many times this process, going into the above and coming down below, has gone on. There's something about that coming up and going down and coming up and going down that materializes something. And that's true in laboratory work, too. Something new comes out of that process. And sometimes it's a stone or a very solid object. Sometimes it's a new spiritual essence. But distillation is a magical process in alchemy. Again, the rebus shown taking place above, just as it takes place below. Another picture of the rebus and serpentine energies. I mean, there's just hundreds of them in alchemy. The idea here in distillation is actually purification, and the color here is white, and the moon is associated with this type of purification. The white color of the moon as it reflects is considered a pure repository of soul, if you will. In fact, Gurdjieff believed, half seriously, I think, that the only reason we exist is to feed the moon. We feed our souls to the moon. The only reason we exist is to keep the moon going. That's a very alchemical idea, too. And these are the two currents, fractal currents of distillation. And this is a Taoist distillation, where it's called distillation of the light. We're not going to have time to do this today. I really recommend this if you want to feel the energy, because this takes a while. But basically, it's sitting in meditation and circulating the energies. You can work with what they call the Qing energy, or the sexual energy, or the Qing energy, which is kind of like prana in the belly, and bringing together in vessels in the body. The main vessel is this Manipura or Tandin stomach vessel, just behind the navel, where these energies are mixed. You mix in the Qing energy and the Qi energy, and by bringing the soul energy and the spirit energy together, you create energy. Okay, by bringing these opposites together, you create energy, and that generates a light. And that light is circulated up the channel of function in the front of the body and down the channel of return in the back. And it's they try to accumulate it then. When this light rises, accumulated in this other vessel in the head. And by doing this, by continuously, and Taoist alchemists do this for years and years, the light materializes. The light becomes heavy. The light becomes liquid. And finally, it turns into a pill. This is a distillation process, a metaphysical distillation process. And that light becomes real. And when it becomes real, it goes to the stomach and becomes an impregnated new energy or new birth that changes the whole body. I really recommend a book called Secret of the Golden Flower, and it's by Richard Wilhelm, W-I-H-E-L-M. And this last process, coagulation, really, if everything was done right before, coagulation is no big mystery, really. Things just fall into place. If the birth is taking place through distillation, if everything you've done before congeals and comes together, the birth takes place, and it's all then an idea about making it real. Coagulation is about making it real in the world. So this whole process is like an octave, if you will. It's the seven original notes of the scale, and the eighth note is a repetition of the original note at a higher level of vibration. So, and it repeats like that, and that's the music of the spheres and the musical interpretation of alchemy. And that's this process that goes on within us. So it's the same thing you started with. It's that first matter, or your ego, or your identity, or whatever it is, or something in the lab, but it's been transformed to a whole new level, or a whole new vibration, a whole new energy level. And that's in the body and spirit. It's universally shown as an androgynous youth, often as Mercury, that resists any corruption, that resists any onslaught from society. Once you're coagulated, it's like being Buddha or Christ in the world. Nothing can get to you because you're pure gold. Gold doesn't tarnish it. Gold doesn't wear. It's completely malleable. There are many images of coagulation because it was the goal. And the final card in the tarot is the Magician at this level. So you start out as a fool, and you end up as a magician. You're basically the same person, but you're at a higher level, and you're able to affect reality then. The fool, in its knapsack, has everything it needs for the journey. This is one of the secrets of the fool card in tarot. It has the first matter, it just doesn't know it. It's a fool. It's carrying it with him, but he doesn't know that it's there for him to transform into the magician. And the fractal coagulation there, and the stone, the symbol of the stone. Any questions on this higher process? The work that's to be done on these processes works anywhere. It works in relationships. It works anywhere. I've given lectures and wrote articles for the California State Supervisors Association on these alchemical processes, changes, and how they apply to the state. And that's the job. You know, what's the ego of state workers? It's the bureaucracy. You know, that's the super ego, or that's a bad term, but that's this grand ego that controls their action. And you have to destroy that. And you tell a state worker to, and I don't mean you, Eric, but you tell a state worker to destroy the bureaucracy, and it's like utter panic, because these people are not alive at work, and they don't want to be alive at work because they've got this thing, this artificial structure doing their work. They don't take responsibility, but they're not alive. And I know you're alive at work. I've talked to you on the phone at work. But it works anywhere. Yeah.
Process, how many times can an individual experience
the shortest time, according to alchemists, to experience this process is three times, the whole process, to achieve success and to end the process. They called it the first seven steps were called the lunar conjunction, because actually in this process you come back to conjunction, you come back to the earth. You don't stay in the above in coagulation. You come back to matter. You know, it nurses the earth. So it's not about going to heaven and sitting there in absolute boredom at this next to Jehovah sitting in a big king's chair or something like that, you know, with angels floating around. It's coming back to the earth and changing and spiritizing the earth like Buddha did and Jesus did. So the end result is back in conjunction. It's back in the world of this. And so the first one's called the lunar conjunction, and which means basically bodily and structural type conjunction. The second one's called the solar conjunction, going through these seven steps again, which is basically mental changes and psychological changes and learning to work with consciousness. And the third one is called the stellar conjunction, which is basically becoming a spiritized body, or, as Hermes said, returning to our home in the stars. The stars are from whence we came. The whole planetary ladder is about hopping back to the stars. 2001 is just a really marvelous alchemical movie about going back to Saturn. Although in 2001 it's Jupiter, it was originally meant to be Saturn. They couldn't do it in props or something like that, so it ended up Jupiter. But it was Saturn, and it was being shot past Saturn into the universe and to return to the stars, and the child that came back at the end of that picture, orbiting Earth, returning to the Earth, the whole thing's an alchemical story. There's an article about it from someone on the Alchemy Lab website in the Alchemy Journal, and it's really an amazing movie. You should watch it again with this process in mind, and you'll see it. You'll be able to identify it every time. The monolith, the black monolith that appears, and I don't know if you remember it, but I know you've all seen it because everyone's seen that movie. But at the beginning of the film, in the theatrical version, nothing but a black screen for several seconds. Then the music starts. Then the movie starts. And the monolith appears among these apes, and I'm sure you know it all. There's that wonderful scene where the ape throws up the thigh bone and it turns into a orbiting spaceship. Remember that? It's like we discovered tools through the intervention of this extraterrestrial, or whatever it was, stone, this monadic stone. And that we've made no progress since then, is what the filmmaker's saying. In other words, throwing that up and turning it into a spaceship, all the millions of years of human history between that means nothing. We haven't changed from the apes. We're still using these material tools. We're just building bigger things, and we're still killing each other. All those millions of years mean nothing in human history because we haven't changed. We haven't evolved. And the monolith then appears throughout the movie. Whenever a spiritual change occurs, there's always an alignment or a conjunction of the moon, earth, and stars in the movie. Watch it again with this in mind, and you'll really be astounded of the message that's being conveyed there. And the overall message of that film, the model, the black screen that appeared on the original cinematic screen in theaters, is the exact same dimensions as the monolith throughout the movie. In other words, the monolith makes an appearance before you even know it. It's that black screen that comes on. And what's it doing? The alchemy. Whenever the monolith appears, there's changes in the people. And that's what the idea of making that film was all about. That there would be an alchemical transformation that would take place. And the symbolism of that black screen at the beginning of 2001 is the monolith. The exact same dimensions throughout the movie as the cinematic screen. And that was the intent, really, to change people. And it did, really. I remember when I saw it, and I've seen it 15 times in many different languages. When I first saw it, people were scratching their heads saying, what the hell does this movie mean? And there was, a lot of people walked out in the middle of it, especially when that psychedelic scene at the end started. They thought it was about drugs, but... that's just one example of a lot of movies that are alchemical. I didn't think it was as much, although the intent was there, I think. 2010 is a really significant date. 2012 really is a significant date in alchemy. May 5th, 2000 was supposed to be a May 5th date, but there's been signatures in the galaxy, really, that there's major changes coming. And for instance, the planetary alignment, and that was supposed to. The Mayan calendar expires December 11th, 2012. The Hermetic prophecies talk about changes that take place in Egypt and that area, and they point to 2012, written by Hermes himself, or whoever Hermes was channeling then, or whatever. There's lots of things that point to that. One thing was the alignment that you're talking about in the year 2000, where all the planets got on one side of the sun. There were books written that it was going to tear apart the planet. But what's significant is that the event occurred just this May on the opposite side of the sun, balancing those energies, coming together like that into what would be major changes in the galaxy, major changes on Earth, and a lot of people think that. In fact, I personally think that we've got 10 years, you know, we should start a 10-year project to change ourselves and make ourselves more spiritual for whatever changes. I don't necessarily believe the planet's going to split apart or anything like that. It may be something like that, but it's certainly going to be traumatic on a spiritual and psychological level, I think. Yeah. Oh, there's a planetary alchemy. I mean, from the beginning of the planet, the calcination of volcanoes and the great flood and dissolution and the separation of the continents and the conjunction coming together. And there is... in the procession of the equinoxes, the next phase is Aquarius, which is traditionally the fermentation symbol, the putrefaction phase coming before. So this short putrefaction phase that we're due for on the planet seems to be lining up for that year 2012. I mean, really, it's time for a personal 10-year project. And I think the way to survive that is to become more spiritual, because it's spiritual energies. Fermentation is always about spiritual energies entering into matter. I have no evidence of that other than these indications and some prophecies. Nostradamus predicted the same thing, an alchemist. That's your alchemist. We've got about 28 minutes to do this planetary tincture, so I'm going to move on to that. When you get your tincture container jar, we're using today chamomile, which is a very solar herb. It has all the signatures of the sun in it. Even if you open the tincture jar, and you'll see that these little flowers really look like the sun. And when they're fresh, they're orange ball-shaped with all these rays coming out of them. They look like miniature suns. They have other signatures. Get to know this herb. Try and connect with the signatures. Smell it. Smell it's sweet, balancing. This herb cannot harm you, really. It's solar. It can build health in the body. It builds wholeness and balance on all levels. And it's a great herb to work a tincture from. The process we're going to be using is the most simple tincturing process, one which you can do, and it's outlined in that orange sheet.
Where do you wear this from?
The herbs or the jars?
The herbs or the jars.
Star West here. Yeah. Now, last year we did, I think, what was it, lemongrass, and I grew that myself and calcinated. Part of the calcination process is this drying. So these have already been kind of calcinated. And what we're going to do is, in the jar, after you smell it, try to get a feel for it. It's of its solar signatures and its solar characteristics. Pour some in your hand a little bit and play with them and crush them maybe. Crush them in your hand. They should crush very easily. We're going to end up trying to crush all these. And you can do it in the jar by putting your thumb against the herb and pushing it against the side of the herb. This process of crushing is also a calcination process. You can look at it as crushing the ego, because we're taking away the identity of this flower. And you want to continue to flush it, but still with a loving attitude, okay? It's not like you hate this herb. It's that you want to release what's inside of it. And attitude's very important during the tincturing process. And just keep moving it around inside there by pushing your thumb down, and you're going to macerate it pretty good here. You're going to get it down, ideally to kind of a powdery state. And you'll notice that it's releasing some odor. And that's the signature, the beautiful signature of chamomile. And just keep doing that. We've only got 13 minutes to do this. Okay? This next stage is called animating the mercury. And we're going to be putting more spiritual energy into this. And it'll be the spiritual energy from this room. And there's a good amount of it here, believe me. So these should be really charged tinctures. To animate the mercury, there's a number of different techniques. Basically, it's a meditation where you put positive spiritual energy into this. We're going to do a Taoist animating the mercury routine. And you want to now... You want to open your herb and put it on the table in front of you and clear away other things so it's kind of right in front of you there. And we're letting the tincture breathe now. And what we're working on is bringing in the celestial breath or the celestial fire into this. So we're letting it breathe the prana in the air, if you will, or the first matter in the air. And by this breathing process, by it being closed up like that and shaped, this is the initiation of this cycle. What we want to add to this is called animating the mercury, animating the spirit. And the way that Taoists do it, Taoist tinctures, one technique, okay? When you get your tincture in front of you, I want you to stand up. Okay, now, with the tincture in the middle of your body, Put your arms behind your back like this, with the palms facing backwards, and then bring them forward like this, and face the palms like that, and then bring them back down slowly. Okay, that's the cycle we want now. Back, behind your back, way behind your back, and then up again, and then turn the palms to face each other. Don't go above your chest too much, even in the chest area. Okay? So you want to sweep the air and bring it up. And this is the original pattern. Now we're going to change it slightly. So bring your palms down and in your back, and while they're behind you, turn your palms so they face forward. Okay, does everybody hear me? Okay, swing your arms behind your back, and then turn your palms facing forward, and then bring them forward. And then turn them facing down, and bring them back to your back. That's it. Palms behind you, palms facing out, palms facing up in front of you, then turn them and down, that's right. Okay, now you've got the movement, and while you're doing this, I want you to meditate almost as if you're moving in a dream. So move very slowly, very slowly. Feel the key energy or the pranic energy or the first matter energy that's in this room, the spirit matter that's all around us. You'll feel it between your fingers as you move them slowly like this. Almost as if you're swimming in heavy water or moving in a dream. That's it. And do this for a few seconds here so you can feel something. Okay, bring your hands up then and bring them down one more time. The next time up, bring your palms facing each other and hold it there. Just below your throat or in the middle of your chest. That's it. Hold it there. See if you can feel something there and play with that. That's an energy. It should be a feeling like a ball, and feel it between your hands there. Move your palms around. Try to feel this stuff. Try to polish it. Try to play with it a little bit. Almost as if there's a solid object there and you're determining its boundaries by where you sense the energy of it. Okay? When you're feeling that, when you feel like it's there, and I can see it here, I want you, normally the Taoist alchemists would take this into their tantien, they'd move it into their belly area. We're going to sacrifice it into the herb. So you want to push it down into your container, slowly so that you have control of it all the time and feel it all the time, and push it down into your open container. Push it down and form it into the container and sacrifice it into the container. And when you feel you've done that, cup your hands around it and hold it there. Just for a second, so that the celestial breath is meeting us here. Okay, now put the lid on it and tighten it really tight, hermetically sealed. That's it. Okay, now, once it's sealed, you can sit down again. Keep it between your palms here. We're going to have to do that for the next 5 minutes or so. If you have a place to keep it on your body, you can put it there to keep it warm. For the men, I don't know, between our thighs or maybe under our arms or... No, the idea now is to keep it warm. It's like your baby. And when you take it home, if you have to put it in your purse or something, of course that's okay. I don't want to say what's going on up there. But the idea is to, we're incubating it, and this is the start of the incubation. When you get home, you can put this in a window, on a refrigerator or radiator. What's going to happen if you do put it in the window? You want to shield this from light. So if you do put it in the window, you can use that dastardly material, aluminum foil. Just don't let it ever touch the tincture itself. But you can cover this with aluminum foil so it'll be safe from the light. Put it in the window. That's really an ideal place. And what'll happen in there? Moonlight's all right, but moonlight for the tincture? No. Not for the elixir, that's a different matter. Yeah. A what? Yeah, a cloth was fine. As long as, that would be better. If you have an incubator, happen to have an incubator, incubator is basically like an ice chest, a styrofoam ice chest with a heating pad in it. That works really well. But a window's fine. What you have to do, though, is pay attention to this. It's like that egg people, teenagers take home to learn how to parent into it. Attention and intention is what we're going to be using to animate this further. So daily, shake it, keep it in a warm place, keep it out of the light, and this is going to go on for a week or two. And you can peek at it once every 3 days or so, and what you'll see is a natural distillation starts taking place in here. The warmness causes the alcohol, which vaporizes at a very low temperature, to start circulating, and it'll go to the top of the container, and it'll drop back down into little drops back into the solution, just as the alchemical apparatus does it, except this is a natural distillation process, completely self-contained in here. And as it does that, it'll concentrate the essences more and more, and the fluid in here will be turning darker and darker, and that's really what tincture means. It means turning dark. And that darkness contains the essence of this. So 1 to 2 weeks, when you feel it's ready to come out, after this, you want to check to make sure it is distilling, that there's little droplets of liquid on the top, and that it's getting darker. And when it gets very, very dark, the darkest you think it's going to turn, that takes about 2-3 weeks at the max. You can open it up, and then you have your tincture. All you do is pour it through a coffee filter, and you have the pure, beautiful green-yellow colored tincture of chamomile. And that can be used, because this is a salt extract or a physical extract, it's really good for physical ailments, balancing the body, feminine problems, and colds and the flu, stomach problems. You can drink it, take a few drops in tea, put a couple drops under your tongue. If it's an acute attack of something and you want to use the chamomile energy, put a drop or two under your tongue and it's absorbed almost immediately. If you want to use it in meditation, that's the way you use it. You put the drops under your tongue until they completely dissolve, until you completely can't taste it anymore, as part of a spiritual meditation. The meditations always are about the sun here, solar meditations. After you have the tincture, you can take it out into the sunlight and use it as part of like a greeting for the sun or any type of solar activity you want to become one with the sun, that type of Akhenaten meditations. It's good for that on a spiritual level, but yeah. Not because it's hermetically sealed. You don't want it boiling, and it's not going to be boiling in this container. So the problem would be meltingness, Just keep it from melting. You're dealing with alcohol, though, and so you don't want it near any, this is really flammable alcohol at this stage. You don't want it near any open flame or anything like that. Yeah, that's a good heat. That's a good heat. Mm-hmm. Furnace. Yeah. And then if you want to make the elixir, when you filter out the tincture through the coffee filter, save everything that's in the coffee filter. Save all that, what they call the dregs, or the alchemists call it the caput mortem, the dead head, the dead salts, the depleted salts, and you use that then to make the elixir. What you do is you take those outside normally and you light them, and then they burn away, and you actually take the ashes and you roast them in a pan. And the idea is to get them as near white or as near light gray as possible, all the ashes of what's left here. And in fact, in alchemy, if you continue heating the ashes, it becomes an elixir. And that's what elixir means. It means from the ashes. You can heat ashes actually until they turn red. It's a long process, 3,000 degrees at a week. But ashes will actually turn reddish color, and that's a very powerful elixir. But you want to get them as white as you can, and by burning them and roasting them. And then you add them back to the tincture fluid that you got in this jar, and you mix them again and go through that whole every day, paying attention to it, incubating it, this time usually much longer, and up to 3 months doing that. And then you have a very charged elixir. And the ashes will, absorb the essence on a higher level. And that those ashes that are left from this, anything that's left from that at the elixir stage, you can use as a powder. And you're not going to get very much. But that powder is an elixir powder. It's extremely concentrated solar energies. And you can just throw them away. If you don't want to make the elixir, you can throw those away. It's all on that orange sheet. So okay, all right. I guess they need this room, so we're going to clear and go down to the bookstore area. We got our tincture down here on the right time. So that's it for this part. If you want to hang around a little bit more down in the bookstore, we'll do the meditation down there. And if you don't stay around, thank you very much for coming, and I appreciate it.